corrupts in chaos. Instead, junior leaders must fully understand what is within their decision-making authority, the left and right limits of their responsibility. Additionally, they must communicate with senior leaders to recommend decisions outside their authority and pass critical information up the chain so the senior leadership can make informed, strategic decisions. SEAL leaders on the battlefield are expected to figure out what needs to be done and do it, to tell higher authority what they plan to do, rather than ask, "What do you want me to do?" Junior leaders must be proactive, rather than reactive. To be effectively empowered to make decisions, it is imperative that frontline leaders execute with confidence. Tactical leaders must be confident that they clearly understand the strategic mission and commander's intent. They must have implicit trust that their senior leaders will back their decisions. Without this trust, junior leaders cannot confidently execute, which means they cannot exercise effective decentralized command. To ensure this is the case, senior leaders must constantly communicate and push information, what we call in the military situational awareness, to their subordinate leaders. Likewise, junior leaders must push situational awareness up the chain to their senior leaders to keep them informed, particularly of crucial information that affects strategic decision-making. With SEAL teams, just as with any team in the business world, there are leaders who try to take on too much themselves. When this occurs, operations can quickly dissolve into chaos. The fix is to empower frontline leaders through decentralized command and ensure they are running their teams to support the overall mission without micromanagement from the top. There are, likewise, other senior leaders who are so far removed from the troops executing on the front line that they become ineffective. These leaders might give the appearance of control, but they actually have no idea what their troops are doing and cannot effectively direct their teams. We call this trait battlefield aloofness. This attitude creates a significant disconnect between leadership and the troops, and such a leader's team will struggle to effectively accomplish their mission. Determining how much leaders should be involved and where leaders can best position themselves to command and control the team is key. When SEAL task units train in assaults, in what we call close quarters battle, or CQB, we practice this in a kill house. A kill house is a multi-room facility with ballistic walls, which SEALs, other military, and police units use to rehearse their CQB skills. For young SEAL officers learning the ropes of leadership, running through the kill house with a platoon provides a great training opportunity to determine how much they should be involved and where to position themselves. Sometimes the officer gets so far forward that he gets sucked into every room clearance, meaning he is continually entering rooms and engaging targets. When that happens, he gets focused on the minutiae of what's going on in the immediate room and loses situational awareness of what is happening with the rest of the team and can no longer provide effective command and control. Other times, the officer gets stuck in the back of the train on cleanup duty. When that happens, he is too far in the rear to know what is happening up front and can't direct his assault force. I advised many officers that the right amount of involvement, the proper position for them, was somewhere in the middle, generally with the bulk of their force. Not so far forward that they get sucked into every room clearance, but not so far back that they don't know what is going on up front. Contrary to a common misconception, leaders are not stuck in any particular position. Leaders must be free to move where they are most needed, which changes throughout the course of an operation. Understanding proper positioning as a leader is a key component of decentralized command, not just on the battlefield. In any team, business, or organization, the same rule applies. The effectiveness of decentralized command is critical to the success of any team in any industry. In chaotic, dynamic, and rapidly changing environments, leaders at all levels must be empowered to make decisions. Decentralized command is a key component to victory. Application to business. Can I take a look at your org chart? I asked the regional president of an investment advisor group. The org chart depicted his team's organizational structure and chain of command. Responsible for dozens of branches and over 1,000 employees, the president was smart and driven. He didn't have a great deal of leadership confidence, though he seemed eager to learn. "We don't really have one that is current," the president responded. "I like to hold that information close. If it gets out and people see it, they might get upset that they actually report to someone they see as one of their peers. I've had to deal with this before." "So how do they know who's in charge?" I asked. "Without a clear chain of command, without people knowing who is in charge of what, you cannot have empowered leadership. And that is critical to the success of any team, including the SEAL teams or your company here." "Let me pull up what we have," said the president. He opened a document on his computer and swung an organizational chart onto the large plasma screen on the wall of the conference room. I stood up and took a look. The team for which he was responsible was a region of substantial size and breadth. There were branches spread across a huge geographic area of the United States. But there was something that stood out to me. The org chart lacked uniformity and seemed disorganized. "What's this here?" I asked, as I pointed to a location that listed 22 people who worked there. "That's a branch," the president answered. "Who leads all those people?" I asked. "The branch manager," he responded. "He leads all 21 of those people? They all report to him?" I inquired. "Yes, he's in charge of all of them," said the president. I looked at another area on the org chart. I tapped another office location, this one with 3 people in it. "And what's this here?" I asked. "That is also a branch," the president replied. "Who leads these people?" I asked. "The branch manager," he said. "He leads 2 people?" I asked. "That's right," said the president. "So one branch manager leads 21 people, and the other branch manager leads 2 people?" I clarified. "Yeah, a little strange, but it makes sense on the ground," the president offered. "How?" I asked. If it wasn't clear to me looking at the org chart, I knew it was highly likely that it didn't make sense to the frontline troops that were out there executing the company's mission. "Well, the bigger branches have more people because they are more successful, and they generally have a stronger manager. Because he or she is effective, the branch grows and requires more employees, which increases the number of direct reports. Over time, some branches can get pretty big," the president explained. "What happens to the efficiency of the branch when they grow?" "You know, honestly, once a branch reaches a certain size, rapid growth slows," he admitted. "The branch manager usually just focuses on the best performers, and the rest kind of get lost in the shuffle of day-to-day business. Over time, most of these branch managers seem to lose track of the bigger picture of what we are trying to do and where we are trying to strategically grow." "And what about the smaller branches?" I asked. "Why do they not grow?" "Surprisingly, it's for a similar reason," he replied. "When a branch has only a couple people in it, there isn't enough revenue for the branch manager to really make money. So those managers are forced to personally generate business themselves. When they are in the field selling, they generally don't have time to focus on leadership and management of their teams, and they lose track of the bigger picture, building and growing." "So what would you say the ideal size would be for a team or branch in your company?" I asked. "Probably 5 or 6, 4 or 5 financial advisors and support people," answered the president. "That makes perfect sense," I said. "The SEAL teams and the U.S. military, much like militaries throughout history, are based around building blocks of 4 to 6-man teams with a leader. We call them fire teams. That is the ideal number for a leader to lead. Beyond that, any leader can lose control as soon as even minimal pressure is applied to the team when inevitable challenges arise." "So how do you lead larger teams on the battlefield?" asked the president with genuine curiosity. "Sometimes for our units, we can operate with as many as 150 personnel on a particular operation," I answered. "While we might only have 15 or 20 SEALs, when you tack on Iraqi soldiers and mutually supporting troops from the U.S. Army or Marine Corps, our ranks could easily grow to over 100 or 150, I explained. "But the truth is, even with all those men out there, I could only truly lead, manage, and coordinate with about 4 to 6, max." I could see this had sparked some interest with the president. "That is why we had to utilize decentralized command," I explained. I couldn't talk to every shooter in every platoon, squad, and fire team. I would talk to the platoon commander. He would take my guidance and pass it down to his squad leaders. His squad leaders would pass it on to their fire team leaders. And they would execute. If there was an army company supporting us, I would talk to the company commander, or perhaps one of the platoon commanders. And again, they would pass my guidance down to their subordinate leadership. Couldn't things get confused? Like in the old game of telephone, where you whisper a word around a circle of people and it comes back different from how it started? Asked the president. That is why simplicity is so important, I answered. Proper decentralized command requires simple, clear, concise orders that can be understood easily by everyone in the chain of command. I spelled out my commander's intent directly to the troops so they would know exactly what the ultimate goal of the mission was. That way, they would have the ability to execute on the battlefield in a manner that supported the overarching goal without having to ask for permission. Junior leaders must be empowered to make decisions and take initiative to accomplish the mission. That was critical to our success on the battlefield, and it will greatly help you here. But can't you end up with a bunch of little individual elements just doing whatever they want, helter-skelter? Asked the president with skepticism. You could end up with that if you, as a leader, failed to give clear guidance and set distinct boundaries, I explained. With clear guidance and established boundaries for decision-making that your subordinate leaders understand, they can then act independently toward your unified goal. I get it, said the president. A mission statement. That's part of it, I replied. But there is more. A mission statement tells your troops what you are doing, but they've got to understand why they are doing it. When the subordinate leadership and the frontline troops fully understand the purpose of the mission, how it ties into strategic goals, and what impact it has, they can then lead, even in the absence of explicit orders. That makes sense, he acknowledged. The teams have to be small enough that one person can truly lead them, I continued. Span of control is the commonly used business term. How many people can a leader effectively lead? In combat, depending on the experience and quality of the leader, the skill level and experience of the troops, and the level of violence and potential mayhem in an area, those numbers vary. You need to find out the optimal size for your teams. And if it is 5 or 6 with a leader at the top, then that is the way you should set them up. From a leadership perspective, I explained to the president, there is truly nothing more important than an understanding of the dynamics of decentralized command. This is proper command and control in a nutshell. It is one of the most complex strategies to pull off correctly. As a leader, it takes strength to let go. It takes faith and trust in subordinate frontline leaders and their abilities. Most of all, it requires trust up and down the chain of command. Trust that subordinates will do the right thing. Trust that superiors will support subordinates if they are acting in accordance with the mission statement and commander's intent. Trust is not blindly given. It must be built over time. Situations will sometimes require that the boss walk away from a problem and let junior leaders solve it, even if the boss knows he might solve it more efficiently. It is important that the junior leaders are allowed to make decisions and backed up even if they don't make them correctly. Open conversations build trust. Overcoming stress and challenging environments builds trust. Working through emergencies and seeing how people react builds trust. Junior leaders must know that the boss will back them up, even if they make a decision that may not result in the best outcome, as long as the decision was made in an effort to achieve the strategic objective, I explained. That complete faith in what others will do, how they will react, and what decisions they will make is the key ingredient in the success of decentralized command. And this is integral to the success of any high-performance winning team. Understood, the president replied. I will make it happen.
Part 3. Sustaining Victory. Chapter 9. Plan. Leif Babin. Ramadi, Iraq. Hostage rescue. They have IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house, said our intelligence officer, with a grave look of concern. It was a hostage rescue mission, the ultimate high-stakes operation. Not only bad guys to kill, but an innocent victim to save. We had trained for missions like this, but they were rare. Now, Task Unit Bruiser had the opportunity to execute such an operation for real. A young Iraqi teenager, the nephew of an Iraqi police colonel, had been kidnapped by an Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group. They demanded his family pay a $50,000 ransom and threatened to behead the young man otherwise. Kidnappings and beheadings were common occurrences in Ramadi and Anbar province in those days. Often, the hostages were tortured or killed, even if the family paid the ransom. These terrorist kidnappers were evil people, plain and simple, and could be counted on to carry out their gruesome threat. For Task Unit Bruiser, there was no time to waste. We needed to put together a plan in a hurry, brief that plan to our troops, and launch as soon as possible. Our intelligence indicated the hostage location was a house on the outskirts of a Ramadi suburb. The roads into the area were heavily ID'd, and the threat extremely high. It was a dangerous enemy-controlled neighborhood, but that's where the hostage and the bad guys who held him were believed to be, and we had to figure out the best way into and out of the area. Our plan had to maximize the chance of mission success while minimizing the risk to our assault force of SEALs, EOD bomb technicians, and our partner force of Iraqi soldiers. Task Unit Bruiser had an intelligence department of a dozen SEAL and non-SEAL support personnel. At the head of Bruiser's intel shop was a young ensign, the most junior officer rank in the Navy, recently graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. He wasn't a SEAL. His specialty was intelligence. He was new and inexperienced, but he was smart, hardworking, and highly motivated. In deference to the character from Comedy Central's South Park cartoon series, we nicknamed this young intelligence officer Butters. Butters and his team of intelligence specialists data mined hundreds of reports and gathered as much information as they could to help facilitate our planning. Meanwhile, we, the Task Unit Bruiser SEALs, set about putting together the plan. As Charlie Platoon Commander, I would serve as Assault Force Commander for more than a dozen SEALs, an EOD technician, and 15 Iraqi soldiers who would enter and clear the house. Jocko, as Task Unit Bruiser Commander, would be the Ground Force Commander with responsibility for command and control of all assets, the Assault Force, our vehicles, aircraft, and any other supporting elements involved in the operation. With the clock ticking, we analyzed the mission, laid out what intelligence we had, and detail the supporting assets that were available, our own armored Humvees and two U.S. Navy HH-60 Seahawk helicopters. We put together a solid plan. A small team of SEAL snipers would clandestinely move into position some distance away to maintain eyes on the target and cover our assault force as we approach the target building. Our assault force would then enter the house, clear all rooms, eliminate threats, and with any luck, recover the hostage. Jocko would remain with the vehicles and coordinate supporting assets until the target building was clear. We would all then return to base and get the hostage to medical care. Moving with a purpose, I drove across Camp Ramadi, the large U.S. base on the outskirts of the city where the bulk of American forces lived and worked, for a quick meeting with the U.S. Army company commander in charge of the area where the target building was located. The major and his company had been deployed to Ramadi for more than a year. They had fought fierce battles against a deadly enemy all through this particular section of the city, had lost several brave soldiers, and suffered many more wounded. He knew the neighborhood like the back of his hand. His tanks and troopers would support us on this operation in the event we got in a bind. The major and his company were U.S. Army National Guardsmen, which meant that at home, they were part-time soldiers. Back in the world, he was a school teacher. But here in Ramadi, he and his men were full-time warriors and damn good ones. He was an outstanding combat leader and professional officer. We had tremendous respect for the major and his company and valued his expertise in the area. I went over our plan with him, and he gave me some pointers as to how we could best get into the area undetected and how his Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles might best support us. I listened carefully. Back at our SEAL camp, known as Shark Base, we finalized an innovative plan designed to catch the terrorists by surprise and reduce the risk to our force while giving us the greatest chance of success. We then gathered all the SEAL operators in the mission planning space to brief the plan. In addition to the SEALs, EOD bomb technicians, and interpreters who would accompany us on the operation, we would link up later and brief the Iraqi troops. We pulled in the key support personnel from our task unit, who would remain behind and man the talk. It was critical that we all understood the plan, how and when to communicate, and what to do if and when things went wrong. Time was of the essence if we were to succeed in this hostage rescue. Quickly, we powered through the brief. I gave my closing comments as Assault Force Commander. Our shooters had just been fed a lot of information. My final remarks were a way to prioritize that information. The three most important things I wanted the Assault Force to remember and keep first and foremost in their minds. 1. Maintain the element of surprise. Stealth is more important than speed as we approach the target. 2. After the breach, once we make entry, speed is most important. Let's get this target cleared and secured in a hurry. 3. Good PID, or positive identification, of any potential threats. Be wary not to injure the hostage, and be ready to render medical assistance. As Ground Force Commander in charge of the operation, Jocko gave his closing comments. Simplifying the complex legalese of our rules of engagement into a clear, concise statement that everyone understood. If you have to pull the trigger, make sure the people you kill are bad. With that, the brief concluded, and SEALs streamed out of the building. Everyone jocked up in their op gear, loaded vehicles, and conducted final equipment checks in a hurry. Jocko and I were the only ones left in the mission planning space, talking through final big-picture details of our plan. Suddenly, Butters burst into the room. "We just got some new intel," he said, in a concerned and excited voice. "They have IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house." It meant the terrorists holding this hostage were ready for a fight, and the risk to our force was high. Butter stared at us with a grave look of concern. Jocko looked at me. "I guess you guys are going to get some," he said with a confident smile and a nod. He fully understood the risks, but he also knew our plan was sound, and our assault force and supporting assets were well prepared to meet the enemy threat. "I guess so," I said, smiling back at Jocko and nodding in agreement, adding a phrase we use when facing anything particularly challenging or miserable. "Good times." We walked out to the vehicles where our SEAL assaulters and vehicle crews were standing by, ready to depart. "Here's the latest intel update," I passed the troops. I told them about the reported IEDs in the yard and bunker machine gun positions. "Roger that," came the response from several SEALs. "Let's get some." They were fired up. That was the task unit bruiser way. It wasn't cockiness or overconfidence. On the contrary, each man knew this was a dangerous operation and that he might very well come home in a body bag. But despite the new intelligence, we were confident in our plan. Our goal was to maintain the element of surprise and hit the bad guys before they even realized we were there. This would give us the greatest chance to rescue the hostage alive and protect SEAL assaulters from enemy threats. After the brief, each individual operator understood the overall plan, his specific role, and what to do if things went wrong. Then, we quickly walked through the operation and rehearsal with full gear. As a result, we were confident we could execute with proficiency. We had addressed and mitigated every risk that we could through planning. But every risk could not be controlled. This mission was inherently dangerous. Whether or not we could rescue the hostage alive would remain to be seen. We loaded up our vehicles and launched on the operation, driving out the gate and into the darkness. As we staged our vehicles some distance away, the assault force dismounted and lined up in patrol formation. I listened for updates from our sniper overwatch on my radio. "No movement on target," they reported. "All looks quiet." Of course, that didn't mean all was truly quiet, but only that they couldn't see any movement. The night was dark as the assault force stepped off and swiftly but silently made our way up to the target building. As the assault force commander, I served as a double check to my point man's navigation to ensure that we were in the right place. I kept my head on a swivel, constantly looking around to keep an eye on the target building and on the rest of the assault force. As we crept closer, you could feel the tension rising. Once at the target, EOD led the way, scanning for IED threats. Our SEAL breach team moved to the entry door and placed a big explosive breaching charge on the door. "Boom! It's on," I thought to myself. With an Iraqi hostage to rescue, we had planned to let the Iraqi soldiers lead the way. But typical for our partner force, they choked with fear and balked at stepping over the shattered and twisted metal of the door and into the smoke-filled room beyond. From here, every nanosecond counted. Our SEAL combat advisors, ready for this contingency, grabbed the Iraqi soldiers and unceremoniously flung them through the door and into the house. This was no time to delay. Our SEAL assault force followed right on the Iraqi soldiers' heels, and when the Iraqis again failed to enter the next room, our SEALs quickly took the lead and rapidly cleared the house. Within a minute, every room had been cleared and all prisoners were under our control. "Target secure," I called out. No shots had been fired. Now we had to figure out who we had captured. A bewildered young Iraqi teen was among those we had detained. We pulled him aside and, after some questioning through the interpreter, confirmed he was indeed the hostage who had been kidnapped. Mark Lee, part of the SEAL assault force, was never one to miss an opportunity to insert humor into any situation. Mark boldly strolled up to the Iraqi kid and, in his best impersonation of Lieutenant James Curran, played by the actor Michael Biehn in the 1990 movie Navy SEALs, said, "We're a SEAL team. We're here to get you out. There's no reason to thank us because we don't exist. You never saw us. This never happened." We had a good laugh at that as the Iraqi kid, who didn't speak a word of English, was nonetheless thankful and clearly relieved to have been rescued from his captors. The plan had been perfectly executed. The first clue the bad guys had that SEALs were there was when their door blew in. We caught them completely by surprise in a manner they had not expected. I made my way to the rooftop of the target building, keyed up my radio, and called Jocko, who was now with a blocking force outside. "Jocko, this is Leif. Target secure." I passed our pro word for "we have the hostage." We had rescued the hostage alive and in one piece. We gave our Iraqi soldiers all the credit. The positive strategic impact of our Iraqi partner force successfully rescuing an Iraqi hostage was substantial. It served as a big win for the fledgling Iraqi security forces in liberating the local populace from the brutality of the insurgency. Best of all, none of our guys were hurt. We found no IEDs buried in the yard, or bunker machine gun positions in the house, though certainly the kidnappers had access to such weapons. We were lucky, but we had also made our luck. We had maintained the element of surprise. Our plan had worked like a charm, a testament to the solid mission planning skills we had developed in tasking a bruiser. Having the humility to lean on the expertise of the good U.S. Army major and his soldiers who lived and fought in this area for a full year had helped us greatly in this success. Back in San Diego a year later, I served as a leadership instructor at our SEAL Basic Training Command. I used this very scenario for a leadership decision-making exercise. To a classroom filled with newly promoted SEAL platoon commanders and platoon chiefs, I set up the scenario. Iraqi kid held hostage, known location, hostage rescue mission planned and ready to go. "Just before launch," I told them, "the intelligence officer informs you there are IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house. What do you do?" There were varying degrees of combat experience among the participants in the room. "Don't go," said one SEAL officer. "It's not worth the risk." Some in the room agreed. A platoon chief said, "Replan the mission." Several others agreed with him. I paused for a few moments to let them consider the options. "Let me ask you a question," I said to the class. "On what capture-kill direct action raid can you be certain there are no IEDs buried in the yard or bunkered machine gun positions in the house?" Head shook around the room. The answer was obvious: none. You could never assume that such hazards weren't waiting for you on a target. You had to assume they were. You had to plan for them on every operation and mitigate the risk of those threats as much as possible. To assume otherwise was a failure of leadership. That was what mission planning was all about: never taking anything for granted, preparing for likely contingencies, and maximizing the chance of mission success while minimizing the risk to the troops executing the operation. In Task Unit Bruiser, we were able to launch that hostage rescue operation despite the new intel of deadly threats because we had already taken those things into account and planned accordingly. We had implemented specific steps to mitigate the risk of potential IEDs in and around the target building. We had carefully planned our operation to maintain the element of surprise so that even if the bad guys were manning bunker machine gun positions, they wouldn't know we were coming until it was too late. Therefore, we didn't need to replan the operation. We were ready. And as a result of good planning and solid execution of that plan, combined with a little luck, we were successful. Understanding how SEALs plan a combat mission provide techniques that apply across the spectrum. For any team in any business or industry, it is essential to develop a standardized planning process. Principle. What's the mission? Planning begins with mission analysis. Leaders must identify clear directives for the team. Once they themselves understand the mission, they can impart this knowledge to their key leaders and frontline troops tasked with executing the mission. A broad and ambiguous mission results in lack of focus, ineffective execution, and mission creep. To prevent this, the mission must be carefully refined and simplified so that it is explicitly clear and specifically focused to achieve the greater strategic vision for which that mission is a part. The mission must explain the overall purpose and desired result or end state of the operation. The frontline troops tasked with executing the mission must understand the deeper purpose behind the mission. While a simple statement, the commander's intent is actually the most important part of the brief. When understood by everyone involved in the execution of the plan, it guides each decision and action on the ground. Different courses of action must be explored on how best to accomplish the mission. With the manpower, resources, and supporting assets available, once a course of action is determined, further planning requires detailed information gathering in order to facilitate the development of a thorough plan. It is critical to utilize all assets and lean on the expertise of those in the best position to provide the most accurate and up-to-date information. Leaders must delegate the planning process down the chain as much as possible to key subordinate leaders. Team leaders within the greater team and frontline tactical level leaders must have ownership of their tasks within the overall plan and mission. Team participation, even from the most junior personnel, is critical in developing bold, innovative solutions to problem sets. Giving the frontline troops ownership of even a small piece of the plan gives them buy-in, helps them understand the reasons behind the plan, and better enables them to believe in the mission, which translates to far more effective implementation and execution on the ground. While the senior leader supervises the entire planning process by team members, he or she must be careful not to get bogged down in the details. By maintaining a perspective above the micro terrain of the plan, the senior leader can better ensure compliance with strategic objectives. Doing so enables senior leaders to stand back and be the tactical genius, to identify weaknesses or holes in the plan that those immersed in the details might have missed. This enables leaders to fill in those gaps before execution. Once the detailed plan has been developed, it must then be briefed to the entire team and all participants and supporting elements. Leaders must carefully prioritize the information to be presented in as simple, clear, and concise a format as possible so that participants do not experience information overload. The planning process and briefing must be a forum that encourages discussion, questions, and clarification from even the most junior personnel. If frontline troops are unclear about the plan and yet are too intimidated to ask questions, the team's ability to effectively execute the plan radically decreases. Thus, leaders must ask questions of their troops, encourage interaction, and ensure their teams understand the plan. Following a successful brief, all members participating in an operation will understand the strategic mission, the commander's intent, the specific mission of the team, and their individual roles within that mission. They will understand contingencies, likely challenges that might arise, and how to respond. The test for a successful brief is simple. Do the team and the supporting elements understand it? The plan must mitigate identified risks where possible. SEALs are known for taking significant risk, but in reality, SEALs calculate risk very carefully. A good plan must enable the highest chance of mission success while mitigating as much risk as possible. There are some risks that simply cannot be mitigated, and leaders must instead focus on those risks that actually can be controlled. Detailed contingency plans help manage risk because everyone involved in the direct execution or in support of the operation understands what to do when obstacles arise or things go wrong. But whether on the battlefield or in the business world, leaders must be comfortable accepting some level of risk. As a U.S. Naval hero of the American Revolution and father of the U.S. Navy, John Paul Jones said, "Those who will not risk cannot win." The best teams employ constant analysis of their tactics and measure their effectiveness so that they can adapt their methods and implement lessons learned for future missions. Often business teams claim there isn't time for such analysis, but one must make time. The best SEAL units, after each combat operation, conduct what we called a post-operational debrief. No matter how exhausted from an operation or how busy planning for the next mission, time is made for this debrief because lives and future mission success depend on it. A post-operational debrief examines all phases of an operation, from planning through execution, in a concise format. It addresses the following for the combat mission just completed: what went right, what went wrong, how can we adapt our tactics to make us even more effective and increase our advantage over the enemy. Such self-examination allows SEAL units to reevaluate, enhance, and refine what worked and what didn't, so that they can constantly improve. It is critical for the success of any team in any business to do the same and implement those changes into their future plans so that they don't repeat the same mistakes. While businesses can have their own planning process, it must be standardized so that other departments within the company and supporting assets outside the company, such as service contractors or subsidiary companies, can understand and use the same format and terminology. It must be repeatable and guide users with a checklist of all the important things they need to think about. The plan must be brief to participants, geared toward the frontline troops charged with execution so that they clearly understand it. Implementing such a planning process will ensure the highest level of performance and give the team the greatest chance to accomplish the mission and win. A leader's checklist for planning should include the following. Analyze the mission. Understand higher headquarters mission, commander's intent, and end state, or the goal. Identify and state your own commander's intent and end state for the specific mission. Identify personnel, assets, resources, and time available. Decentralize the planning process. Empower key leaders within the team to analyze possible courses of action. Determine a specific course of action. Lean towards selecting the simplest course of action. Focus efforts on the best course of action. Empower key leaders to develop the plan for the selected course of action. Plan for likely contingencies through each phase of the operation. Mitigate risks that can be controlled as much as possible. Delegate portions of the plan and brief to key junior leaders. Stand back and be the tactical genius. Continually check and question the plan against emerging information to ensure it still fits the situation. Brief the plan to all participants and supporting assets. Emphasize commander's intent. Ask questions and engage in discussion and interaction with the team to ensure they understand. Conduct post-operational debrief after execution. Analyze lessons learned and implement them in future planning. Application to business. We've got to establish a planning process, said the company's vice president of emerging markets. Our success has stemmed from sending our experienced people into new areas. They figure things out, put a plan in action, and as a result, we win. But as our company grows, as we enter new markets, we need a standardized process for planning, a repeatable checklist others with less experience could follow. The emerging markets VP was an impressive leader and a key driver of the company's overall success. Like a good SEAL combat leader, he was aggressive and exercised extreme ownership to solve challenges and accomplish his mission. While he didn't have much patience for the company's bureaucracy, his drive made him highly successful, and he pushed his team to the highest standards of performance. His leadership and personal efforts had directly contributed to the company's rapid expansion and growth, with hundreds of new retail stores and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. His team was highly effective, establishing strong footholds in areas that had traditionally been dominated almost exclusively by their competitors. They were making bold moves, and as a result, huge gains. I had just delivered an Echelon Front presentation on SEAL leadership concepts to his emerging markets team, and in the discussion afterward, the VP had turned to planning. "I constantly harp on my team about planning," said the VP. He asked one of his key leaders, a regional manager, "How many times have you heard me harp on planning?" "Constantly," the regional manager responded. I could tell the regional manager respected her boss, but her body language indicated she didn't share his concerns about the importance of establishing a planning process. No doubt she was thinking, "We're doing well. Why do I need to take on the additional pain and paperwork requirement of writing down a planning process and teaching it to my key leaders?" But she was wrong, and her boss, the emerging markets VP, had great strategic vision in understanding the importance of planning for the company's long-term success. Early in my career as a SEAL officer, there was a time when I felt that military mission planning was needless and burdensome, I told them. But I was wrong. Establishing an effective and repeatable planning process is critical to the success of any team. I told them how I had learned proper mission planning and briefing through years of trial and error and many, many mistakes and iterations of doing it wrong. It started back in my earliest days of SEAL training. "The PLO is for the boys." It was a statement often repeated in SEAL platoons and task units when I first joined the SEAL teams. That statement implied that the brief for a combat